Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Oh Brother, a podcast about Salford/Manchester's legendary musical institution, The Fall. Each week we invite along a guest to chat about their experiences and memories of the group. You can find us at Spotify, Apple and all usual suspects, but we're hosted at play.acast.com/s/Oh Brother. All episodes are also available on YouTube. Search for Oh Brother Podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. This week we're joined by the 41st best stand-up ever, the very brilliant Stuart Lee. He talked to us before his wonderful Snowflake Tornado show at the Lowry in January. Hope you enjoy it.
Hello, welcome to the latest edition of Oh Brother, a podcast about The Fall with me, Paul Hanley, and my esteemed brother, Stephen Hanley. Delighted to say we've got our guest today, he's none other than the estimable Stuart Lee.
Thanks,
comedian, writer, broadcaster, TV star, 41st best stand-up in...
Hanging in there.
Is it going up or down? With a 41st with a bullet?
I don't know.
who decides them things?
The public.
Is it GQ?
No, I don't know what that... One was a mix of... When it's decided by broadcasters, like the Dave Channel, I'm never in it. They just sort of forget. I don't think they consider to me to be a comedian of any sort. But sometimes when the public vote for it, I get into them. But then it sort of depends... Like everything these days, it depends on whether you've got an active social media profile.
Yeah.
And I haven't got one at all. So either, I'm off it. So.
Well, I mean, we'll probably talk about that. We'll talk about the fall at some point. But that must be quite... Do you not get a push from management of things that you should have?
No, but I know there's certain jobs you can't get anymore because the first thing people do is look at how many followers you've got for something.
Yeah.
And I also think that rumours grow about you because everyone else is instantly there to clarify what's been said about them.
Yeah.
But as a Fall fan, I quite like it, the unfocused mystery that surrounds things where, you know, I liked not really knowing and the group not being the sort of group that had a presence where you knew them as personalities.
Yeah.
You're focused on the work.
Yeah.
You know, so I kind of think...
It's because we didn't have a personality.
No, there's no person.
But it's funny that because it's that whole thing with The Fall, because there's certain people who are obsessed with it, and it's like it's gradually everything's being found out. So there was, you know, did they play there in this year? I have no idea. And it's they're filling in the blanks now, so that basically, at some point in the near future, someone's going to be able to tell you everything you did between 1979 and 1998.
That's true of everything, isn't it? I found this really pro-feminist quote by Tony Parsons. And I thought, from now, right? And I thought, I bet, and you know, cause you, I thought, I bet he said something the opposite of that in the past. Right?
Yes.
Because that's the thing now, isn't it? Like, can you, people getting caught out by what they've said
yes,
before?
Yeah.
So I just put loads of different combinations of Tony Parsons and different words into search engine. Eventually, I found this scene
from
2003 where he was saying women are the same as bananas and he likes them firm and fresh. I was going, oh, yeah. But it's just that, I mean, everything is found now, isn't it?
Yes.
Everything is found, yeah. But then it is amazing. I mean, I was thinking about the first time I saw The Fall was at the Elephant Fair, but also, weirdly, earlier on in that day was John Martin. You know, you might remember.
Yeah.
And a 16-year-old in 1984 didn't know who John Martin was because the immediate past just evaporated.
Yes,
you know,
it did.
And he came out, and this bloke, he looked like nothing. He did this amazing hour of like echoplexes, you know, which, again, I've never heard anything like it. And I was saying to people, who's that? And old hippies are going, it's John Martin. Like, why don't you know that? And, of course, pretty soon after that, he became not very good anyway.
Yeah.
You know. Then the other day, I was thinking about it, and I thought, I wonder if, you know, that's there. And I put John Martin Elephant Fair into the search engine, and a recording comes up of a couple of the songs. It was just as I remembered it, with not many people there, old people talking. And, you know, everything's just...
Yeah,
it's amazing now is when you can't find something.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
yeah.
But there isn't a full recording from Elephant Fair. I don't believe anyway. I don't
think I've got one.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the set.
I've got it on a little tape. You know, when you used to go in the market.
Yeah.
About a week later, from getting the little tapes with a
I was looking at the set. That was quite the greatest hits. That set. There's six singles in the set. Yeah. That must have been our festival set. I must have been Brix's influence that.
Yeah,
because
it
was far more crowd pleasing. Well, it's all relative.
Well,
isn't
then
it?
A really long version of Garden as well. Never go on too long, as far as I was.
Well, we've got that's the thing. The Peel session version of that is longer than some other Peel sessions.
Yeah.
It's just relentless, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting that, because, I mean, there's that recording onto Charles Turns where he's shouting, stop bloody improvising. And yet it seems to me that, unless Mark didn't notice that's what you were doing, that a lot of the songs are built on fairly sturdy foundations, then with lots of like improvisations over them.
Yeah, that was the Cal thing, wasn't it? If you can get that one note and do something with it for 15 minutes, that's when you... Like Andy State and all that, I mean...
Yeah, that was the kind of thing Carl taught us, didn't it?
Yeah.
To use that one riff and play it in loads of different ways and build it up and drop it back down again. And we learned that from him, really.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. I mean, because that first album is him doing whatever the hell he likes.
And
it's just like... So when he went off and came back, he was slightly more under control, if you like. But that's when I think he was brilliant, Carl. When we had the two drummers, he was just off the chart drummer. I was just, in awe of him, really. You know, but having said that, I play all the good bits on Garden anyway. But...
Yeah. do you know what he's doing now?
No.
I was saying everyone knows everything.
Yeah,
except about Carl.
So where Carl Burns is.
We tried to track him down, didn't we? When Paul's book came out.
Right.
But I went to the last place that I'd known where he was living, but...
The old Asian woman sat in the living room didn't know much about him, did she?
No.
He's the Uncle Ben of The Fall, you know, the only one they don't bring back to life, I think.
Yeah, he's managed to move.
Yeah, I mean, it must be, he's deliberate on his part. I mean, fairly recently you had contact with him.
It's not that recently now, it's when the Fallen came out.
Yeah.
The Dave Simpson book, he rang me because they'd been in touch with him for like an extra chapter for the paperback, and he was debating on whether to do it or not. He ended up not doing it, and then he rang me a couple of times, but that's the last of it from
him.
Why did he not do it?
I don't know.
Because he
didn't like the way he'd been portrayed through that book.
Did you ever discuss how he was portrayed in your book? Or did you never get that far?
Well, I've not been in contact with him since...
Oh, of course, the Fallen was before, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So he's definitely not getting back in touch now. No, I'm joking. He comes across very well.
Yeah. Actually, but then another thing about it is all the books, you know what, there's so many there's about four I haven't read now, you know, that have come out.
You have to keep up.
You know.
Yeah, there's another one coming out soon.
Is there another one soon?
It's You Must Get Them All. It was a blog.
Oh, yeah. That's a good blog.
It is, but it's... Yeah. Yeah, it will be a good book, I think. I think it's a great blog. I don't know what. Have you had a copy of it then?
No, but he's. I think he wants me to write an intro for it or something. No, another one of my main jobs is writing. But there's so many different books now that, as a fan, you realise it makes you think about what is a true story. Because so many different people remember things differently. You know,
a lot of it, I don't think there is such a thing as a true story.
When we made that documentary about the Nightingales with Mark Cumming, I'm really glad you thought, it's very kind of, but that became immediately apparent from the start that no one would remember the incidents the same.
Yeah,
so we made that a feature of it rather than trying to get a definitive thing. We would cut it to immediately someone saying, I was there and that never happened.
John Taylor,
we had to get him on like one day in between being in Barbados and outer space.
because I thought that watching Let It Be. Get Back.
So
if you watch Let It Be and then you watch Get Back, they're two different stories, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember watching that Beatles documentary that came out, the sort of 12-part one in the early 90s.
Anthology.
Yeah, and all I remembered about that period was... Funny enough, I started doing it on stage last night, his voice and this bit, and no one in the audience knew what the fuck I was doing. But when George Harrison's going, my only desire is to please you and be happy. Yeah. To Paul McCartney. When you've only seen that bit, you think, God, that must have been an awful period.
Yeah.
But then you watch that 15 and a half hour long Jackson one, you go, oh, no, it's like anything. It was all different bits. Yeah. And that's what you get from all the four books, actually.
Yeah.
That it wasn't, everyone had different highs and lows. So,
Well, it's like that. Let It Be turns out to be about Lindsay Hawk at the end, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think he's the star of the film. There's a great bit where they pull him up on the roof and he's like, I'm making no effort whatsoever here. And then Paul McCartney's pulling him up on the roof. This is Paul McCartney. He twisted his finger here. But I thought that was brilliant, Peter Jackson.
Yeah, it was really good, wasn't it? I mean, and it also showed... it showed people trying to collaborate.
Yeah.
And, you know... And also, he was, Lennon in that period, like, he was just on heroin, he was useless, but it's only the first bit when he's useless. He wakes up a bit towards the end.
It was a terrible idea. Well, let's all sit round in a studio. It's like a film studio, it's like a big bloody. It's like a warehouse, and they just have to sit there with 14 million cameras on them and write an album. It's not the easiest.
No.
So where were we? We must talk about this, the fall that must come up at some point. So King Robert, I was going to say about King Robert. Do you think that's a possibility? Not that one you'd want to do, but how you'd make a definitive thing about the fall? Because there is that one that they did
That wasn't great.
It wasn't great.
The Wonderwall track.
Well, I remember being a talking head in one for the BBC about 20 years ago.
Right.
I think it was called The Wonderful Frightening. I suppose the difference
now is... Your bit was good. I was going to say your bits are very good.
They were. I mean, I suppose... I don't know. I mean, I suppose the story's sort of finished now.
And there was... Mark had a lot of say in that and who they talked to.
Yeah, I guess it would be easier. The thing about the Nightingales was they were... if you're a John Peel listener from the 80s, you know who they are. But to most people, it was unknown. So what it became was a story about some guy trying to do a thing for 45 years. And people like my stepfather's partner is like, 80, related to it as that and wasn't really interested in it being about how post-punk impacted on the industrial Midlands. The thing about the fall is so many people got a stake in it, haven't they? It would be like a nightmare to... So many people feel that it hadn't represented, or it had represented, or it wouldn't, I don't know. I really don't know how you do things. We did that film just the way we did it because as soon as we started filming it, we realised that everyone had different stories. I mean, it happened here, actually, on Mark Riley's show. That was the first bit of film we did, and I realised that in that day... No one could remember everything. I think it all contradicts each other. We're going to have some fun with this, But there's a lot of footage. The other thing about the Nightingales film is there's hardly any footage, right? We didn't have much of a budget, but in a way, it wasn't a problem because there's only like three bits of film with them. Whereas there's a lot of stuff, isn't there?
Weirdly. Surprisingly, because obviously the Hacienda thing was a big thing because they filmed everything.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of film from that. But even like in America and stuff, there's that, totally wired and not from the book club. You never see bands at that level.
Thing on that Tony Wilson program from like the first album, where a single light bulb in what looks like sort of a cellar in a prison.
That's John Cooper Clarke's house. That
was it.
Yeah, because that was Eric, who's the bass player. He John Cooper Clarke sort of gave him the fall, if you like.
Oh, right.
That'd be too good. Yeah, so he was John Cooper Clarke, one of his musicians, and he said when they were looking for a bass player, you should have Eric. He'll do. So that's in John Cooper Clarke's house. Now. I don't know where it is. It's somewhere up in Rawnstall.
It might just be too big a story as well, because that's the thing that's the thing about that book about all who've been in it. That became like a sort of social history of post-war. What sorts of people did different things. If you focused in on a bit of it, like just your story or someone that was in it for 9 months or something, maybe that would be a way of, I don't know really, you know.
Because it's a shame that it ended when it did, because there's, and I know you've talked about that last 10 years, it's been like a happy ending in a way, isn't it?
I've been listening to the first 20 years today. that is one that sort of got a through line, isn't it?
Yeah, really. Yeah,
mainly built around you, Steve. You know, being all the way through that period, and that sound is so distinctive to it. You know, and then the last 10 years seem to have an identity. I'm not saying it was the best, but it did seem to have a stability to it.
Yeah. I think it was probably what Mark thought was the best. I think it served him better. And I think weirdly, they got to be more the Fall that he wanted them to be because he left them alone to do it, which is a bit of a, you know.
Yeah, I think it's, I don't know. Don't know from close up, but as an onlooker, it seemed to serve him better because he got to the point where he wasn't concerned about the intricacies of arriving at the correct point in songs. Not that it was ever a huge concern, but the sort of music that you were doing with him had middle eights or it had
verses and
there were structured things that he would have to get right. And then he got to the point where really it was a it was like a platform that had a relationship with sort of rock music, but he could kind of do what he wanted.
Come in and out and do what you
want. So from the case in point being, when the lineup before that fell apart in Tucson or somewhere on a Tuesday, by Thursday he got another American post to play these six simple riffs, and that became quite a good lineup.
Because
that suited that thing.
It's great, that Dark of My Love, that's them, isn't it? Because he didn't do that. When Steve left, if you look at the gigs they did immediately after that, it was like Julia and a Casanova.
No, I saw one with Baggy Tip Pop, which ended with Michael Clarke holding a stool over his head. And that was the "If It's Me and Your Granny on Bongos" is all quote. And I don't know them. I remember speaking to, I remember it was at the Dingwalls. I remember Damon Albarn and Juliet Frischman from Alaska, I think, were a couple at the time, sort of standing at the bar looking traumatised and shell-shocked while members of the public tried to comfort them almost. It was really strange.
That's what you're probably thinking. People think I like this shit.
It was just worrying and baffling, you know.
Yeah. But the
thing to get up and do it is, that gig was actually booked. That was supposed to be I was booked to do that gig. That was the next gig after we got back from, supposed to be the next gig after we got back from America.
Right, okay.
So it was fairly recent, it's fairly short.
Pretty quick, short order, yeah.
You got to give it info.
This feels a bit ghoulish, and I think I feel bad about talking to you, but I know Carlton B. Morgan, who's a writer from South Wales, and he'd written a novel with this American writer, Camden Joy, who's a great novelist. They wrote a novel about an archaeologist trying to find the severed head of the statue of Pan in South Wales, and a guy who knew him going to see the fall on that gig where everyone fell out, right? Mm-hmm. And the stories kind of cross over.
Right. Because there's a graphic novel about gig in here as well.
Carlton had got the film of that. He got a film of that night. And it was a weird thing to see. And then when they were making that BBC thing, The woman said, do you know anyone who's got the film of that? And I went, well, I do, but it feels like an absolute betrayal of trust to tell anyone where it is. Yeah. But they did find it somehow, you know.
It's all on, it's all on YouTube now, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it sounds great.
Yeah.
It does. When you actually all get four of you on stage at the same time.
Did you feel relieved about that in the end? Afterwards, or more about it finishing like that, or
no. I think, you know, if you do something like that for 20 years and you reach 40, you kind of think that this is you. No, I was quite cast adrift.
Right.
Yeah.
Quite traumatised by it, wasn't
you? Mm.
Yeah.
Well, it was not so much that, it was the years building up to it before it, which were pretty grim. I did try writing a follow-up to the thing we were doing. Oh, I've said this in the podcast.
It doesn't matter.
During the lockdown, but it was just too difficult.
Was it? I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was just, it would have been a, what we call a misery memoir.
Yeah.
So.
Hey, only for a bit, though, do you not think? But then
we get it together, and then we join Tom English's band.
Yeah.
But then you start writing about that, and it's... Did a good gig, had a pint, went home. It's like,
there's not a lot.
This is not interesting.
It's the chaos and fear.
It might not be what you want to do, but it's certainly easier to write about what you would think.
But often you write that.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, that becomes there's no story there. Yeah.
But that's what I thought. I've been, you know, there's no story to what I do now. I can't place like this, and actually here. I can be back at the hotel on the other side of the docks by 11 in bed. if I'm playing my cards right, you know.
But it's a wearying thing, though, isn't it? And I wouldn't like to think he did it deliberately, Mark, because there's no tension and there's no artistic tension. So you've got to make everyone's life a fucking misery in order to create enough creative tension to move you on.
Well, a bit of that.
That's a bit depressing.
Yeah, but a bit of that I can see, but... When it goes over the top, when it goes too far.
But I don't think, the falls, it's not what people get from gigs, I don't think, anymore, do they? They're all very slick these days, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things. You know what, I was in the Imperial War Museum here the other day. When lockdown started, I thought, I'm sick of wearing these boring masks. I'll go on Reddit and see what they've got that I like. So I've got some of Italian Westerns, one of something. I've got one of the first... I've got a face mask somewhere of the first album lineup from the floor. I thought, I better not wear that today. Look a bit weird, but I've told you about it anyway. I was coming out of the Imperial War Museum, and the security guard woman went, oh, come here, love, let me embrace you. And I thought... Uh-oh, she's seen a gig of mine, and, you know, it'd be all right. And she went, and then she didn't know who I was. She wanted to talk about The Fall, right? And so many people do this. If they know you're a fan, they bump into you somewhere. People talk about how they went for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, some people, and they miss the sort of, football fan aspect of it, where you were committed to some team.
Good or bad, yeah.
Yeah, and you didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah,
you know what going to... And you didn't... And you didn't... If a gig went really wrong... It didn't matter because there'd be another one along in 4 months' time.
Yeah.
And that would be totally different. And sometimes you could go 3 nights in a row to the same venue and the new people are working something out or whatever, and each night would be completely different. And that is an anathema to people now. They want to... I mean, I went to see Idols, who I liked, the other day, and it was great. And one of the things about it was the lighting show was... uncharacteristically well thought out for a rock gig, but afterwards I thought, well, that means they've got to hit certain
cues exactly certain the same points. Every night.
There's got to be a certain, whereas you know, you didn't really know with, and it wasn't just because we didn't know what state Mark was going to be in. Sometimes it would be because the whole thing would lock into something, it would go up a level, and you didn't really know.
Well, you've talked about that before. You could play the same riff one night and play the same the next, and it'd be shit. I'm not sure how you quantify it.
But that is the same with like there's two bits, just four or five bits in this current show in the stand-up where I can go to different things if it picks up. And there's a guy who's been three times this week, and he sits near the front, and it's become quite funny because I started talking to him last night. I got to this bit about cesspits, right? And on a good night, there's this one word of it, that usually makes the audience really laugh, and I can go off into this improvisation that I can change every night. And it didn't happen last night for whatever reason. They just didn't laugh at this one word they normally laugh at. And I said to the bloke on the front row, I went, that's weird, because I can't do that bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was 15 minutes last night. Yeah. I said, I can't do it tonight. You've seen, see what I mean? I said, see what I mean? See how hard it is for me? Every night I have to make choices in real time about where, what direction to go in, and yet I still have to get back to the main story of it. It's very difficult. And then he went, well, it is your job.
That's really shining daylight on the magic. I know you do that when you do transcribe the books, but that's cheating, isn't it? Do you get resentment from other comedians from that? Or
Has anyone else done that?
No, that's what I'm saying. It's like the magic circle, do you know?
I think it's funny, you know. I only brought it up, though, because, you know, you can listen to recordings of the same, like that whole America tour period and the Australia-New Zealand one. I mean, there's a lot of recordings of the Australia-New Zealand period now, and within a week, the whole thing kind of changed completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, when those started coming out, when the Melbourne one came out, and then all the New Zealand, the extra ones that weren't on Fall in a Hole, and that's absolutely fascinating, is it? Seeing that one night it could be 15 minutes, another night six, the same thing,
yeah,
and totally different spins on things.
Well, I think that was it's the author of its own demise, that line. I think we got a bit too good at it. It's obviously is subjective, but
yeah.
I think he thought we were turning into a band. I think that's what he didn't, and obviously clearly that's what he did with Room to Live. And yeah. I know you really like Room to Live.
Yeah, but it's an act of self-sabotage.
Yes,
yeah.
And I can look at it now, the way I'm looking, because since I wrote the book about X, I can look at it now as a piece of work. That's quite clever. That.
Yeah,
but it's always been coloured by our experience.
Yeah, but it's not the logical progression from X.
No, not at all.
It was like he tried to shake people off or something.
Well, yeah. there's no like about it. He definitely did try to shake people off. Yeah. That was definitely his intent.
And musically as well, though, because maybe given 6 months, those songs might have been.
Well, they did. If you look at Marquee Cha-Cha, I remember that one that's on Room to Live is seriously probably, if not the first, then it's the second time me and Steve had ever played.
Really? Yeah. The actual recording that's on.
Right. Well, you can tell if you listen to it. If you listen to it with that in mind, you think, these fuckers don't know what they're doing here.
Yeah.
Which is kind of great in a way.
Yeah, I know it is, because sometimes the same with the radio sessions, isn't it?
The
first one as well.
Yeah, well, that's the great thing about Peel sessions. Yeah. But you don't put that out as your makeup, do you?
No.
Normally.
No.
So, I was talking about bands that can do that. The only person I can think of, Dylan does it a bit, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But, I mean, that takes some doing that. But then you've got to have fans who are absolute obsessives, haven't you?
Yeah, I took my kids to see Bob Dylan. They were 9 and 12 at the time. And I just thought, you know what, you should do.
Yeah.
And I do really like him as well. But I appreciate his frustrating because, you know, it was at Hyde Park. No one knows what the hell he's playing. there are people that they're holding up their phones with the that app on, you know, trying to identify the song.
Shazam!
He was playing something and it'd been going on for ages. No one knew what it was. And my daughter went, "Oh, it's Blowing in the Wind." Is it? And then these old Dylanologist blokes in front went, "Yeah, it is." She sort of picked up something. But I think he's great like that because he for him there's not a definitive version of any of the songs now.
That's right.
Each one is just a moment in time. And I was lucky enough actually to get a copy of this 20 CD thing of everything that Dave records in the studio in 65, 66.
Yeah.
Now if you've got the time, which I did have in the first half of lockdown, to go through it all and hear how they were all spun is really great. But I think it's a brilliant thing to do that because it reminds those audiences, and a lot of the people that go to Dylan, they want to hear the hits, they don't really know what they're going to get.
It's too big to do that, isn't it, in a way?
It's just a strange thing in between. He comes out from behind the keyboard after about every 3 or 4 songs. He just sort of stands like that and looks around with his hands on his hips and then goes and sits back down again. Absolutely bizarre.
Well, he can't stand up to sing, so, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I'll just go and have a sit down.
Yeah.
He's of the age where having a sit down is an activity.
Yeah,
what are you doing this afternoon? I'm going to have a sit down.
But, you know, apart from the obvious gap in economics, and I think that there's a lot of similarities between the Dylan and the Four.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
The different people that come in. could completely change the sort of the feel of it.
Yeah.
And yet there's an identity in it that drives it along as well.
Which is always interesting because it's The Fall, isn't it? It's not Mark E. Smith.
Yeah.
He could have done that, couldn't he? He could have done that quite easily. If he'd have said to you, Martin Brahma's leaving. I'm not going to call it the Marquis Smith band. You wouldn't have said, no, I'm not fucking doing that, would you?
No. Well, I met Robert Fripp once from King Crimson, and I'm sure you're all huge fans. But he said that King Crimson existed as this kind of entity that was beyond him, and he knew when it was time, when something was King Crimson and when it wasn't, even when it was completely different people. He seemed to have a sort of idea in his head of what it was, and I think there is a sort of idea of what The Fall is to a fan, and it can encompass a thing that sounds a bit like Italian dance music, and it can also encompass something that sounds like a Stooges outtake.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to say exactly what it was, which is weird when people say it all sounds the same, because it sounds more radically different than
it
with a comparatively long lifespan. Yeah. You know, most people have to keep knocking out things that have some relationship.
You have to sound like yourself. So why is Post Nearly Man not a Fall album, then?
Because there's not enough music.
Yeah, it's spoken word.
It's Mark talking with a load of racket in the background. Yeah, you'd never get away with that on a Fall album, would you?
No, it's just different enough, isn't it? That's,
I don't know.
The answer is probably. It was probably, you'd know more about them. It's probably down to some contractual obligation.
Very possibly.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, because he was never interested in being a solo artist, was he? What I always hated about is me and your granny on bongos, you know, because it clearly isn't you and your granny on bongos. You can tell when it's you and your granny on bongos. Yeah. And it's really, I think it's quite insulting in a way.
It was insulting, and it was probably meant to be. Defensive, wasn't it? And it was also a way of, a lot of what he seemed to do was about shutting down discussion, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't want to have to answer particular kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. So in interviews, he would say obtuse things or behave strangely. So, and I was supposed to interview Rocky Erickson once from the 13th Floor Elevators for some paper, and everyone said he'd gone mad and he thought frogs were orchids and stuff. He did much the same thing. I think he had gone a bit mad, but he partly pretended to think he was from space or something because he didn't really want to have to
tuning
his guitars or whatever.
I really miss that with interviews. They're not like that anymore, are they? An interview with Mark E. Smith, it was completely separate from listening to a record. Yeah. It's an event in its own right.
I suppose that is the thing. There's this other body of work, isn't there, which is the stories that surround it, that are created by him, by his reaction to him, and then by other people's contradictory memories of what they were. You know, there's a story in your book that I made up.
I know.
Okay, I'm glad you know that. I feel bad about it. Did you know at the time that I'd made it up?
I've talked about this with the publisher.
So I did a sort of experiment. I thought, I wonder if you make something up.
I have talked about this with the publisher, with Selwyn, and he said, because Mark used to do that.
Right.
He would send, it does come up online every now and again that Mark E. Smith sent me a postcard from where.
Paul researches should put one up, haven't he?
Yeah.
From the scars.
He used to do that for every NME, every Christmas they'd get a card from him. And so, we rationalised it it's a story, but it shows Mark. It shows how Mark was.
Yeah, it was I think it's a story about Franz Kafka. I just thought, somebody was asking me about it, I just thought, I wonder if we just make something out, like what traction it would get. I can't imagine it would end up in you.
But it's the spirit of the. I know this gets a bit wanky at this point. Yeah. It's in the spirit of the. That's what
I thought it was plausible.
Well, that's what I think, without being funny, that's what's quite amazing about your book is it's like a novel, isn't it? That kind of, even if it's not exactly, because you've got me saying stuff I never said. I wouldn't in a million years have told Bricks that Elves was a rip-off of I Wanna Be Your Dog. No way, because you'd have come back and told
me. We come back round to the people's memory of it.
I'm braver in your memory than I was.
He's improved you in his memory.
It's
a lot of it's scenes, isn't it?
Yeah.
Obviously, you set the scene, you're in some dressing room, and you're trying to remember what people say, and you say what you believe they might say.
Yeah, well, I'm quite prepared to say that I said, this is a complete lift if I want to be on. Great, that breaks, yeah, thanks, yeah, can't wait to record this.
Well, there was about four complete lifts of want to be by the end of the of the run of the whole thing.
I mean, it's a good riff to Nick, isn't it?
Yeah. Nothing exists in isolation, does it?
No.
And that's another thing, mate, you're talking about making, if you wanted to make a film about the fall, you'd have to communicate to people the mindset whereby things were not known, were they, beyond a certain... I mean, you were in, like, the biggest cult band that your mum hadn't heard of.
Yes,
you
know that's right, yeah. Sort
of a really hard thing to explain there.
It was one of the... What do you do? Well, I'm in a band. What are you called? The Fall. Never heard of them. You know, that was... I mean, that was...
And the next question.
Do you remember...
Have you ever been on Top of the Pops?
You ever been on Top of the Pops? No.
No.
Yeah. With us, it was always... with me, it's always, did you ever play Jongleurs? Because our office goes there at Christmas. And I go, no, I'm going, I've got a 6-night run at the Salford, you know, Lowry. And I go, yeah, but have you done Jongleurs as we go there at Christmas? Do you remember the Moodists?
Right? Yes, yeah.
Dave Graney's still going on, I get on very well with him. He wrote a great book called How to Be a Bludge or something. Anyway, part of it was about when the Moodists were a peel band in the 80s, and he was working in shops and stuff in London and restaurants and things, and people would go, what are you? You go, I'm a musician. And they go, oh, my brother is in a weddings covers band, actually. You should get together and jam with him. And he'd go, well, it's not really like that. Then one Christmas, because he was Australian, the office where he was working gave him a T-shirt of Nick Cave. And he was like, they had members crossing over, and he would always be opening for him. And it was so funny. He's really good on that, how fucking embarrassing it is having to explain what you do.
Yeah.
Where you're in this twin world where some people are going, oh, I can't believe it, I love your stuff. And then even your own family are going, never heard of you.
Yeah, right?
And then they come and see you and they're embarrassed because it's not what they thought. You know.
We talked about that. We did an episode at Christmas with our two brothers who are, you know, obviously.
Yeah.
And basically, it was just my brother Harry saying, I always thought you were shy. And we took a book with him. The family folklore is that he came to see us at the preacher and brought a book with him to read. He reckons it was for on the bus and he never got it out.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm still not convinced. But that whole thing was like, my mum and dad never saw the fall. It wouldn't have crossed their mind in a million years.
Yeah. Weird, that, isn't it? Not even the ballet or the play anything.
I mean,
the only time my dad ever saw me play was the band we formed after we left the Fall Arc at the Witchwood in Ashton-under-Lyne.
You did him no favours there?
Jesus.
No, but I mean, it wasn't what dads did, I don't think.
But also it wasn't, you know, it's hard to go back to that time and remember when things could just be not known, be viable, but you know, not known.
But that whole idea of a cut off as well, where dads don't listen to that's gone as well now, completely, hasn't it? I mean,
yeah, I mean, that is weird. I mean, it's difficult for my son because obviously, one of the things that kid tries to do is they try to establish their own identity, and he got into Mogwai, you know, and he's going, have you heard this? And I went, oh yeah, I saw them at the George Roby in 1993, playing to 12 people, opening for the Scud Mountain Boys, who were alternative country band. I could see them go,
ruined that for something else.
Not happened to you yet, no? Not too cool for you?
I think so.
Thanks, mate. Yeah, you straight in with. But that thing about the fall is, it's gone now. People I talk to seem to know who the Fall are now.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. And they seem to be thought of as significant. And I think, actually, it's a bit like Barry Cryer died yesterday.
Yes.
Like, loads of people dimly knew who he was. He sort of faced on things. I don't watch the panel shows, but I know he's been on a lot of them lately.
Yeah.
But suddenly, the obituaries enabled you to see that since 1953, he wrote for all the first wave of people.
Yeah.
And then he was also able to write for Dave Allen. And then he was also, in the end, part of sort of our circuit as well. And then when you add all that up, people he's sort of not noticed in his life almost. And then it really adds up to something. And I think it was a bit like when the obituaries came out. People realised that this thing was actually gone on for ages and was quite significant, and wasn't just this sort of background noise in the middle of the afternoon at a festival or something.
No.
It was like a thing that had really done something. And I think it is a shame, but that does happen a lot, that it takes the end of something for people to understand it.
Definitely.
And actually, even as a fan, actually, when it finished, it's quite nerve-wracking being a fan of The Fall, because you worry what's going to happen next.
It's incredible, that, isn't it?
You know, it was,
what a thing to say. Imagine being unless it was Slipknot and you thought someone might throw a knife at you. Why would you ever be scared?
Because also, you were, when it finished, you could sort of get a perspective on the whole
thing.
And I suddenly found it much funnier than I ever had, and it seemed sort of really absurd in a kind of surrealist art kind of way, that you had this voice of this man that, by all accounts, couldn't really sing, but going over all these different kinds of music over the decades, and loads of the words that were like social commentary jumped out more when a line was drawn under it. It sort of made it just made more sense when it finished, as does Barry Cryer, although he's not a similar thing to them.
Well, it is kind of the you know, it's that old thing of the Velvet Underground thing, that people not that many people bought the album, everybody did, went out and formed a band. So it was that comedian's comedian kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it's good actually, because the last 2 days all these Barry Cryer jokes have been doing the rounds, they're all the sort of jokes you kind of forget that are really funny, and people think they can tell them but they can't.
Like, no.
You know, a couple are walking along the street and the wife goes, "Isn't that the Archbishop of Canterbury over there?" And the bloke goes, "I don't know, I'll go and ask him." He goes over, "You the Archbishop of Canterbury?" The bloke goes, "Fuck off." He goes back to his wife, "What did he say? Is it the Archbishop of Canterbury?" "Well, he just told me to fuck off." And she says, "Well, we'll never know." It's only with the end. Once I was in a car with Tim Bradford, who's a writer, and he said to me, "Do you know loads of people in showbiz and comedy?" I went, "I don't really know anyone. I sort of know Harry Hill socially and Kevin Eldon, the actor. Other than that, I don't really see anyone. I'm not really." And then the phone rang and I took the call and went, "Oh yeah, right." And he went, "Who was that?" And I went, "It's a Barry Cryer." Makes it look like he used to ring you up.
I was going to ask you that when you were on your phone.
Oh, well, I was, and of course you think you're special, and then the obituaries come out. There's about 500 people, and like, he used to ring me every year. I went, "You must have sat there all day ringing everyone's birthday."
And a joke for everyone. Great, man. But he was the good thing about it. Well, lots of good things about him, but he never got to that. These comedians, these things.
No, he didn't. And actually, he was good in the opposite direction, because he wanted to let us know when we were young that actually everything before 1979 wasn't just people going, "There's my agent family have moved in
there." Yeah, yeah.
He wanted you to know that there'd been other kinds of stuff, and he'd been part of that. So he was really good like that.
Yeah.
You know, and but again, it's funny, these sort of gateway things. That's sort of what, you know, that was another thing about The Fall. If you're lucky enough to get into it as a teenager, it was more difficult in the 80s because you couldn't find stuff, but you were pushed towards finding out about Can or Captain Beefheart. And then some of the, in the words, the allusions to different writers and stuff were...
Definitely.
Or even the name of it. I mean, I read Camus at 13 because of The Fall. Because it was... that and Peel and BBC Two was a kind of alternative educational.
Yes.
If you followed the tributaries then.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was that. It's become that whole thing of clever working class people. I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it seems to me that it's almost impossible for it to be a working class musician and clever and have something to say at the same time. I think,
well, it's because a lot of the little support networks that you could get by and have sort of disappeared.
Yeah.
Like squats, grants for education, things like that.
Yeah.
You know. So we think we're more free and we've got more options, but actually lots of things have...
But I mean, it's the term of it. Oh, I'm done about it. But it's in everything now. Acting. There's no...
Yeah.
You know, that was that big watershed moment when Bowie and Alan Rickman died at the same time. And it was like the last working class actor. Because it doesn't exist really. Well, my nephew's trying to be an actor. And it's... You've got to be in London at 9 o'clock in the morning. And by the way, we might call you back at 7 that night. So that's 2 nights in a hotel in London. For the merest sniff of getting anywhere. So you're not getting that from, you know, campus.
And the music is pretty much the same, isn't it? You've got to have money now to
do it. You can. And what surprises me about music is how good musicians everybody are. The idea that Pete Hook could go and see the Sex Pistols, buy a bass from Maisel Radio, and be playing a gig a week later, you know, with dots written on the top.
Yeah, but the other thing that you get is they don't seem to develop creatively at the same speed, because there's this sort of slight, I think they've finished it up now, but there's this sort of hippie-ish kind of 70s style sort of folk rock band that I like called Wolf People. And they made about four albums in a decade and a half because they all had to have jobs.
Yeah.
And you know, that you would have done that in 2 years.
Yeah.
And with the development.
Yeah.
But everyone was hanging into some cheap housing by the skin of their teeth. Or some part-time job or piecework or whatever, mm-hmm. and getting a bit off the music. And but it did mean that the acceleration was fast. But then also these sort of major label indie bands, they have to go and work all the different territories, don't they, and then come back and do the next.
The
development's kind of held back by economics and marketing.
Well, especially now, I mean, with the pandemic, closing gigs.
Yeah.
There is no, I can't see there's any viable way to be an indie band, and that's what do you do for a living? Yeah, I mean, a band that plays the, you know, small venues, and you couldn't be done.
You don't want to sound like someone. I mean, I always think it's like someone going, oh, they don't, this should be Dry Stone Walling. Why is it Breeze Brooks? Yeah. But there's no skill in it. But you feel that actually, with comedy, what's happened is that the show you're coming to see tonight, there's not going to be many shows like that in the future, because that's a show written by someone, and it could be anyone, but it's a show written by someone who can earn their craft on the circuit,
doing
5 nights a week in clubs, and trying to put a sort of 20 minutes together and then an hour, and then you end up doing 2 hours and you have an idea of how it all fits together. What happens now is someone get really famous from doing 90 second things on the internet, then they try, and then the promoter tries to put them out there. And the show, that's what the show's like. The show's like little things stuck together. It's not like a piece, you know. And because actually the process of discovery is too expensive now for them for them to move to a population centre which has got more than 20 clubs in it at the age of 21 and try and do it. They need to get on with... They can't afford the rent. They can't do what we did, which is basically take 10 years off route to sort of... risk and see what happens, and you know.
So is it still comedy? Still everyone writing their own material? Because it never was, and then everybody was.
It wasn't until about 79.
Yeah.
Then it was, and now most of the people that are, if they're a big name, and they also do acting and TV presenting, they're probably not writing it.
Right.
But and well. Some of them, it's out in the open, so we can say Jack Whitehall was written by Freddie Syburn, his stand-up. Frankie Boyle has a number of people, but to be fair, he does have a distinctive sort of tone, so they kind of know what they're writing for, and he does write as well.
Mm-hmm.
Michael McIntyre, a lot of it is Paul Tonkinson. A lot of it is old material, actually, just changed a bit.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything wrong with that, though? I mean,
well,
if I'm playing devil's advocate,
depends if you're coming across as you're
okay. What I think's wrong with it as a shop steward, is that if you write a hit single or a play,
mm-hmm.
your name's on it and you get royalties on it.
Yeah, yeah.
What tends to happen with those people is they get a day rate for going in and workshopping.
Okay. Well, I suppose there's no royalty rate for I wrote that job.
But then it's not like the tour of that person doesn't say written by so-and-so.
They hide it on panel shows, don't they? They put scripts at it.
They call them program consultants.
Program consultants,
That was, I felt so naive, and I'd never done any of those. And I went along, when I was getting married, I was in a bit of trouble financially. And I got offered one, and you know, it was about £600-700 or something like that. You know, it was like a lot. I found out later everyone else was on about 3 times. I went along to it, and then you need to go in the writers' room. And I thought, what? And then all these people have written loads of stuff for the show that if you want it, you can learn it and say it.
Right.
And I thought everyone was making up. I had no idea. I felt such a bloody idiot. And of course, when it started, I just did not know what to do because I didn't understand that it was a sort of an act of learned things being said, you know. And I felt so naive. And I did 3 of them, and I never did them again because I liked it. One of the nice things in that film with Rob Lloyd, this is what I was thinking about, why I couldn't figure out the panel shows, is he, you know, he's funny, right? But you sometimes sort of manoeuvre him to a point where you give him the laugh.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You
sort of. You kind of do yourself down to allow him to what you know, you can sort of for the camera, you can kind of work a conversation round to a payoff point. And they never really do that on those shows. They all sort of step on each other, you know.
Yeah.
So, and I suppose you do that. That's the one thing when I have done music that I've liked about it was the element where you make space for other people.
Yes.
Or you can see it's better if they. If something goes at this point and you support it rather than, you know,
there's no reason why you couldn't.
It's about the bigger picture, isn't it?
There's no reason why you couldn't do that on a panel show. You would think at the end of the day, if this is a funny show, then we all look better. Well, surely that.
Yeah, I know. I just think everyone wants to get noticed. You know?
Yeah.
People want to get noticed now, you know. But you don't want to be sitting in this dressing room in the afternoon sounding like you're going, you know. Why can't everything be made of wood?
It's like a Damon Albarn thing. He picked on the wrong person there with Taylor Swift. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Of all the people that picked, Jesus Christ, A, she does write stuff, and B, there are 14 billion people who are going to jump on you for saying
I noticed that with this group, Wet Leg. Have you seen them?
I've not seen them.
That started off that they'd been put together by men as a sort of, well, I thought, well, they probably haven't, but it really quickly attached itself to women groups.
It does,
But I think, weren't the Kings of Leon, you'll probably get libel, but didn't the Kings of Leon, didn't their uncle write it all or something?
There is the rumour that allegedly.
And was he in the Remains or some 60s garage band?
Very possible, I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, I've heard that before. But then that all came out that, people arguing against what Damon Albarn said. Well, you wrote all the songs for Elastica. Then. Hang on a minute. You're just doing what you've just accused him of.
They're old wire songs, aren't they?
Well, they are old wire songs, Not that there's anything wrong with ripping off Stranglers. Stranglers, what am I?
Yeah. Actually, that's the thing. That's another thing. Since the Fall stopped, is you can sort of see, with the benefit of hindsight, you can see all the things that went into your period from other people that you know you kind of and how they get mangled and changed around and you know because every because like you say people have made studies of it now
but I think what was in our favour is we were never really good enough if you rip something off we were never really good enough to play it properly
so it came out
completely different
hey Me and Sue Maggot, right? Is that Adamski single?
Apparently, according to Mark Riley, that's where Mark nicked the riff from. Yeah, that Babysitter.
I've got the.
But because the interesting thing with that is, he's credited on the album to Smith because he wrote it all.
Yeah.
But if on the PRS database, he's credited the music to Mark Riley. So he's either made a mistake or he thought if they come after me, it's going to say Mark Riley on the credits. I wouldn't put it past it.
No.
Good record that.
It is. Yeah.
What was he called then?
Was it called?
They were called
Stupid Baby.
Something like that. But he was about 11,
wasn't he? Yeah,
he's
about 11,
yeah. I think we're about to the hour point.
Yeah, I think.
Don't want to keep you too long. I know you've got to do your warm-ups and your
vocals. I have to do a long period of Pilates before I...
Personal trainers come in at 4.
That's, you know what? It's if I'd got on top of this, I would have just interviewed you two for an hour about things I wanted to know about. But I might start a podcast.
Well, if there's anything you want to get up.
The Elephant Fair, that Elephant Fair.
Oh, we never got to talk about the Elephant Fair.
That was a really big deal for me because I've been listening to the Fall for like 3 years.
So how old were you then?
When I was 16.
So you've been listening since you were
13. 13. Yeah, actually, the first thing I heard that I remember going was Look No, so that'd be 81, 82.
Yeah.
And in Birmingham.
Is it still running?
Yeah. In Birmingham, it was quite difficult to see things because a lot of the venues were very. There was a lot of tight licensing about things, and you didn't tend to play in sorts of places where a 13 year old, And I said to my mum, can I go and see the Fall at this festival? And she went, no. I went, why? Because there'll be loads of people on drugs, and it's miles away, and you're going on your own. And she went, all right, if you do all right in your O levels, you can. And I did. Right. So thanks for that. I ended up at university on the incentive.
Changed your life. There was one thing I wanted to pull up on. That you always say you had the drumstick of mine that I threw into the audience.
Yes,
there is no way on God's earth I threw a drumstick into
the audience. No way.
Well, I've got.
How did he get it into
the How did it get into your hands? Because I would have then had to go back to Mark and say, can I have some money for drumstick?
No, it's broken. It snapped.
Right, okay. Even so, unless it broke while I was throwing. But who do you think I am? The drummer I had made. I wasn't throwing the drums.
I don't know. Well, I've got it in a pot with a bit of piano that Mercury Rev smashed a bit. So it's in the archive of the Holy Object. So I sort of go. I could go there, and so I went there, and of course it was exactly what I never seen anything like it, but I saw a lot of. It was a little festival, wasn't it? They used to be a little old hippie festival. And I remember seeing a lot of early alternative comics. I like the Pegley and the Politicians and Malcolm Hardy, which was good. And then John Martin in the afternoon without knowing what he was. Then you lot lit by... There were flames, wasn't
there? Yeah, there were torches.
Flames on the side. And also seeing the group wandering around in the afternoon as a group and looking like they had an identity. And it was interesting... You looked so young as well, which was weird. Mm. Thinking, not much older than us, even though there was already four or five great albums in the can.
Yeah. Know?
And I just remember it being absolutely just spellbinding because it was towards the end of. That was my favourite period to that point, and it was towards the end of that, and there was still enough linkage back to the big epic tracks of Ex-Induction Air and Perverted Boy Language and stuff. And but then it was also interesting feeling that tighter sort of popular stuff coming in. But yeah, you know, it was great. And then after that, I went and wandered about. And I've only really worked out years later that I was obviously spiked with LSD or magic mushrooms or something, because I have all these memories of it. And then years later, I think, that obviously... I remember going in this tent. And this woman saying, do you want some mushroom something? I went, oh, yeah, right. And then there was a covers band on. And I've always been saying to people for years, there was a covers band on at the Elephant Bear in this little tent. And they played a version of The Fool on the Hill by the Beatles. It went on for 4 hours. And it was all like changing and it's only a few years later I thought. They also thought on the same after watching this 4 hour performance of
how long were you there?
I went out and I one of my O levels that I had to do well in, you had to do a project in history, and I did this sounds so precocious, but never mind. I did the difference between King Arthur in mythology and history, right? That was my O level project. And I read this got to these old things like Nennius was a 8th century Welsh monk who wrote about King Arthur, and I remember coming out of that 4 hour performance of Fool on the Hill and having a long conversation with a man who said he was an antiques dealer and he had read Nennius, and talking to him for ages about Nennius and thinking how weird it was that I would meet this bloke. Of course, that obviously didn't happen.
I mean, the best friend in the world, how did it come up in conversation?
Exactly. How did it come up? I know you were there. I know that was before this.
Yeah.
But the great thing about that is that I got that out of the way, I realised, without even knowing it had happened. You know?
That's probably the best way to do it.
Yeah, but it was absolutely... I mean, it's a very vivid memory of the torches on the side of the stage. Mm. And then after that, you know, I was old enough to get to see The Fall, you know, a couple of times a year.
Right.
Although I had a weird period between about 92 and 95 where I went to kind of Oedipal struggle with it. And I thought, I just keep listening to this all the time. And I sort of stopped for about 3 years and I missed what was quite a good period, I think.
92, 95?
Yeah, after when it was a bit electronically and then before it went
back. Dave Bush period.
More like a garage band, yeah.
I thought, that was Lost in Music, which I think still say is the best cover version of The Fall ever did. Miles.
My brother-in-law in Sweden has only heard one Fall album and it was that one. And he goes, I love the bit when they're in the pub and Lost in Music's playing and he's obviously arguing with the landlord about the kids being in there and trying to say something in French. I thought, oh yeah, if you don't know, it's like a sort of piece of comedy drama almost where he's sort of going, put the money on the table, but to someone in another language. Or
Sur-le-tableau.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's... Because I was never a massive fan of Ghost in My House, and because they're a bit straight, aren't they?
Straight,
yeah. But then it's that, I mean, it's not, I'm not going to stick me that and say it's better than the Sister Sledge version, but it's you know, it's, I think it's fantastic. That.
Yeah.
I remember when it was suggested. I was thinking, oh my god, I've got to play like him.
God, like Bernard Edwards.
Yeah, yeah.
The last time I saw them before my 3-year divorce from the four was at the Glastonbury about 91-92, wasn't it? I think. You were on the main stage in the afternoon, and then the next time I saw it after that was at that story in about 95. So it was only like a 3-year period where I didn't. And then the last 20 years, it was.
Because you've seen them a lot.
Because you could always get to things, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
But how did you. When you did the Spinal Tap riff, were you not worried about being. That's so obviously the same. Were you not worried about. I know it's funny that Smith didn't know what it was.
No, he knew what it was. Yeah, he knew, but I don't know.
He'd seen Spinal Tap about 5 million times.
There's a thing that he'll put on the torpus, yeah, but I don't know. I always had that thing that by the time everyone, like, because the guitars and things like, yeah, and by the time everyone's putting.
Give over.
Finish putting everything over the top.
You must be still joking. It's still exactly the same.
Sometimes you don't get away with it. we haven't got away with it.
What do you think when you hear things now, like this? Have you heard this tune yards, are they called? Or,
no. Yard Act.
Yard. Yeah. What are they called? Yard.
Yeah, we're talking about like before, Leeds
band, yeah.
Tune yards. That's how you
put your dad,
isn't it? Yeah, this.
He's learning it.
Are they like the Fall?
I don't listen to the album. There's bits, yeah. Where is it?
It wouldn't exist without the Fall.
I don't know. But you can hear it, but.
Well, it was just at the time, wasn't it?
I listened to them and thought, they're good, but there's no energy in it.
Right.
They don't seem to put the energy in. I don't know that we were like.
I'll tell you what it is. It's sort of similar, but it isn't. It isn't confusing in the way that you were.
I thought, come on, lads, put it on.
Who was I watching the other day? And I was thinking, it was Thingy's new band, Tom York. I can't remember what they called them. I can't remember what they called now, but I was watching them and I was thinking, will you hit them, fucking drum? You know, tippy tap. Will you hit them? But apart from that, it's very good, but I don't like drummers who piss about like that.
Who's your favourite drummer then?
Of all time, Ringo, it's got to be.
Really?
Ringo and then John Mayer on a bus because I think that's a more fanboy thing, but if just, I think Ringo completely. Bring up the book.
He's maligned, isn't he?
He is unbelievable.
You see in that film that, you know.
You look for that film. I mean, I can't leave so much here. Nobody tells him what to do at any point. They tell George what to do. Paul says to John, it's this. Yeah. John says to Paul, it's this. Yeah. Bingo sits at the back and then he comes up with, you know.
With something.
With something that's exactly right for the song. Yeah. And I think he is much maligned. And I think, I don't know why.
No. And what about with bass? Because your bass doesn't sound like anyone else.
Ooh. What, favourite bass player?
Yeah. It's not like I think.
Yeah, favourite bass player. Who have you tried to play like? They're two different things, aren't they?
Yeah. Not really trying to play like anyone, I don't think. No. Tracy Pugh, he was good. Oh, right. Birthday party.
Yeah, you've tried to play on Tracy Pugh.
I've got a joke tonight that only you will understand.
Oh, really?
It's based on knowing an early birthday party track, and the audience laughing at it, but I know no one knows what it is now.
Well, listen out for that.
Tracy Pugh. Were you on something like An Older Lover? Were you able to have quite a lot of. Fun with that. That's a lot led by the bass, isn't it? Really, when there's everything else is space around it. Was that something where you could change things a lot? Or?
I can't remember how that came about. Now that's how we wrote that.
I don't know. I don't think anybody wrote it. There's certain songs and you certain things. Nobody, like Ed Priest, I always say, nobody wrote that song. It was just five people in a room just playing what they want themselves. You know. It's been Mark suggested that he wrote it, but there's certain songs you think nobody has said to somebody play this, and that's one of them.
There is songs where Craig said, I've got this bass line, and Mark and other people, but yeah, that's not one of them.
Mark's theory is that under pressure, by the Queen's ripped off an old
So again, I sort of think, again, you know, when it all finished, you look at some of those things, you think he was trying to create, it was a private joke. Say these ridiculous things. And say that something that never would have heard of him was copied off him. And I kind of get that, because I sort of, sometimes it's just easier when you're being interviewed to just change the subject and say something that, you know, will draw the fire away.
I love that about his interviews. I mean, I before I joined The Fall, and when I first joined, his between song part was it was almost as good as the songs. He could rip the, you know, you can hear it on Tall Tales Turns, you know, are you doing what you did 2 years ago?
Someone's done a book of that.
Do
you remember a group called The Country Teasers?
Vaguely, I don't
know. They were like Edinburgh sort of rockabilly band, but the attitude was very like The Fall in terms of he'd write about socially contentious subjects, the guy, and they did a song that was exactly the same as Fury Jack, and in it he started saying, people say I've copied this off Fury Jack and I haven't, right? So that was really funny. So at the end, this is about 20 years ago, I shouted out, are you doing what you did 10 years ago? And he went, no, and I won't make a career.
But he kind of, he steps away from that, because I think people are talking about that more than the song. And then similarly in interviews, there's a period with his interviews, and you just think, I could read these interviews and never listen to it. I don't really need to listen to The Fall to me. These interviews are just great. But then it came up a bit sort of parody of himself in a way, which because that's when we had Martin Brahma, we had him on the podcast, and he was saying this character that he created, Mark sort of created this character that was half him and half Kay Carroll. When Kay went, he created, you know, he got this character that was like, you know, and then the problem with that is with any of them is when it's you, it's your name, you get, it becomes you, doesn't it, and you become it. So
no, I mean, I have trouble with that really to some extent. When this has been taking me so long, especially writing this introduction to this book, The Bloater, which has been out of print for 52 years, and I really like it, and obviously turned up on the search engine as the best well-known person that likes it, because everyone else is three.
Well-known for writing forwards.
And then he goes, I know that I've only been asked to do it, really, because I'm an E-list celebrity, and that might, there's obviously some professor in Indiana that's better at it than that. And I thought,
but he's not better at writing introductions.
I thought, what am I supposed to be writing? Am I supposed to be writing as me, or is it supposed to be the comedian, or an awkward mess of both? And I wish I'd made the distinction. You know?
Well, yeah, I tell you, I always think that about Al Murray.
Pub Landlord,
using his real name for that.
Yeah, I know, it's really really weird that that happened. I lived with him at the time he was developing. Character, and you know, I just never thought it would be that popular.
Right.
But then he had a thing that, you know, he had a difficult thing where the problem was that started out as a sort of parody of something that in the end became mainstream thinking.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, and the you know, a lot of the people that are going along just agreed with it.
Yeah,
and
you're fucking that, aren't you?
Yeah, especially when it comes out that he's basically an upper class member of the aristocracy. I mean, I think actually, if Mark hadn't died when he had done, the polarisation of British politics might have been a difficult thing for him to write about.
Yeah,
because he liked to take a contrary position.
That's right.
For either because he believed it or for comic effect, and I don't really care which it was.
I'm not sure he even knew himself.
But the problem now is things are so polarised, and it's not the establishment of Etonian people say that they're fighting against the establishment of the Labour Party and woke people. It just doesn't. I don't know where he would have landed now in terms of, and I expect it might have become quite uncomfortable.
I think he'd it's best he'd have been clever enough to sidestep it. You'd like to think, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But it's difficult to not express a real opinion about the shit that's going on now.
I've thought over the last couple of years what Mark would have made of all this, though.
I think you would have got some good stuff out of 2 years of lockdown. But I think you would have said people were weak for staying in their houses.
I don't think he'd have been the greatest mask advocate, do you?
Of course,
I think in a way the reputation of the group may have dodged a bullet there. It might have been really, because a lot of people are saying some weird things. I mean, like Janis Coleman's a anti-vax,
is he?
Isn't he? Yeah. There's some, and Van Morrison as well.
Van fucking Brown. Well, I mean, the only thing I'll say is Eric Clapton couldn't have gone down in my estimation. No, so that's all right.
Yeah.
Always thought he clearly is.
No, that stuff never stuck to him, did it? Though all that rock against racism stuff.
Not enough. I mean, it stuck to him a bit among certain people. But yeah. I mean, that wasn't a coy one sentence in an interview with the Guardian. You know, that was the standing on stage saying.
Yeah.
I mean, just unspeakable stuff.
Yeah.
And he still bounced back for him, and he still gets sympathetic. Treatment. Right, we're not ending on Eric Clapton, are we?
Please move it around.
Yeah, you have to move it. Get Eric Clapton towards the beginning.
It's good if you can end on a sort of hanging cage. Someone going, and I sometimes wonder, you know, it might all have been different if something had happened like that. And then he goes, thank you for joining us. You finish like that.
There you go.
That's how you finish a podcast.
Well, that was the one we did at Christmas, was it ends on with Steve saying, we'll have to cut that bit about Rolf Harris out. that was my brother Harry. He said, I saw two people at the Hacienda, Rolf Harris and The Fall, and right. I'm less embarrassed about seeing Rolf.
Which one do you regret the most?
Brilliant. Have you seen that All Women's Fall covers band?
The Fall did Iceland, didn't they?
I did Garden, actually.
Oh, did you?
The Fall of Women,
they'd have been a good lineup of The Fall. They really take their time over working it all out. I think it's quite a good little exercise for them, you know. It's interesting again with that, how which ones work and which don't, when people try and change things, you know.
Because we've tried Totally Wired. You'd think Totally Wired would be the easiest one in the world to do. We've tried it, we did it with Tom, we did it with Extra Care. It's been shit every time we've ever done it, so much, as far as I'm concerned. Because it turns into some. Because it's a. The thing about Totally Wired is it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's got a structure, which is unusual for the film.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it ends up lasting a quarter of a fucking hour and pissing about.
Anything but Totally Wired.
Anything but Totally Wired.
The last
Shadow Puppets version is quite like the way we did it with the Extra Cane, which is not bad, but there's still too much, you know. We're going to get a bit edgy here now. We're all going to drop it down, and all, which was great on some Fall songs, but that's the one song that doesn't need it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stuart.
Right, thank you, and not just for today, a life changing, you know.
That was like you.
You must get people saying that all the time.
Thanks for joining us this week on Old Brother. Episodes are released every second Monday, so watch for the next episode in 2 weeks. Please follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show, where you can find a link to Spotify and subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, give us a rating on iTunes, subscribe on the YouTubes, or just tell your friends. For further reading, you can check out our books about The Fall, The Big Midweek and How a Bleeding Guess, which includes a foreword by Mr. Stuart Lee, available from Root Publishers and all good bookstores. Hope to speak to you all again soon. Remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-ra.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.